Good morning, everyone. You hear me? Am I okay? Yes, I'm okay now. Joan, thank you for that wonderful introduction and the story for all ages. As some of you know, I am a fisherman. I enjoy being immersed in water, fly rod in hand, a deep breath before the first cast of the day, and then the concentration necessary to see the currents that will tell me where the trout might be feeding, and the hope that I will find them there. It is never certain. Immersion is a good word because the experience is not just the water I'm standing in. There are birds to listen to, insects buzzing, and of course, the symphony of water itself as it picks up speed, swirls, wraps itself around rocks, and tumbles from roar into a slow movement. I am enveloped. Mindfulness seems to be the current term for being peacefully connected to experience. I like the word and what it signifies, though regrettably, I am not a constant practitioner. I'm happy to say, however, that when I'm fishing, I do manage a state of consciousness that from time to time seems to qualify. The literature of fly fishing is replete with stories of thousands of insects hatching in great clouds and elegant casts of carefully tied imitations drifting into the mouths of eager trout. My experience, on the other hand, is seldom seeing fish rising to insects anywhere. And if there is any elegant casting on hand, it will be from the guide downstream. As for me, I watch the currents and try as best I can to understand where the trout may be holding. More importantly, when I'm in a state of mindfulness, there is a greater joy of which the act of fishing is a part. I'm a person generally resigned to life as it is, so I enjoy a day when I do not catch fish as much as when I do. And the ones caught go back. For as a pioneer in the sport wrote, a trout is much too valuable a resource to be caught only once. And I also know where they are after that, too. As for not catching fish, my good friend Charles Gabriel is fond of saying, catching fish is not what the sport is about, which I take to mean that a day without fishing is still a day fishing. And the act, when mindful, becomes a metaphor of connection. It is the metaphor as connection that I would like to explore here today. While on the water for the last 30 years, I have had three times the blessings of coming upon the fluttering mating dance of butterflies. Hundreds in a spiraling column 6 feet high. I have sat down on the gravel each time, at a respectful distance, of course, and marveled at the pale yellow color along the edges that deepened in intensity through the center of the column until almost golden. It seemed at once an abstract painting, and because it was alive, a vision of the life force. On each occasion, I felt that I had stumbled onto something that most certainly is not a rare occurrence, and yet its beauty and kinetic energy made it seem solemn and ineffable. Those three spiritually profound experiences should seem miraculous to me, and mostly they have come to be so, though not without a challenge that I struggle to resolve. By training, I am a product of the Enlightenment and an apostle of Darwin. So calling this almost impossible choreography of butterflies a miracle of creation would certainly have me tumbling into intellectual heresy. What I saw did not come off a divine drawing board, but rather through incalculable generations of biological refinement. And yet, as I think about the butterflies, there is something that draws me away from a measured phenomenon of nature, away from the biological analysis of a mating ritual. There is something in that perfect shimmering dance that the Enlightenment cannot explain. In chapter 21 of the Poetics, Aristotle provides a mathematical description of how metaphor works. He writes, Metaphor refers to the process where a name belonging to one thing is transferred to another, as when A, the name of a genus, is applied to one of its species, or B, the species to its genus, or C, the name of a species to another genus, or D, in a transfer based on proportion. I really hope that is just a bad translation. But in any case, I prefer my butterflies. They, of course, are quite precise, quite mathematical in what holds the column together until their dance is complete. They flutter up and down the column, together and apart, in the same way a school of fish can turn in perfect unison in the blink of an eye, or hundreds of early morning commuters can exit a train station seemingly thinking about hundreds of different things, but never collapsing into a mass of colliding bodies. For butterflies and fish and us, what seems miraculous can be explained simply as a brain-based response to surrounding stimuli, albeit a fascinating example of collective consciousness. This is what neuroscience tells me, and I accept it as true. But I identify it also as metaphor, as do the seams and currents and eddies of a trout stream give me a sense, but never the certainty, of where fish may be found. The mating dance of butterflies give me a sense, though not the certainty, of where I may find the sacred. The Enlightenment, as we know, was not about metaphor. We are in the debt of thinkers as disparate as Descartes, Voltaire, and Kant, who quite literally pulled us out of a long, dark period of secular and religious terror, dominated by those who would manipulate fear and superstition for their own ends. Today, we no longer believe in the hidden world of magic, dark spells, and strange signs, though the internet does give me a rather long pause. The Enlightenment, of course, had many currents. There was Kant's belief that reason was to free humankind from the inability to use its own understanding without the guidance of another. It sounds like Kant was a closet UU. For Francis Bacon, it was the great dawning of the age of reason. For Mary Wollstonecraft, it was time to end the presumed supremacy of men and advance educational quality for women. But while the main tributaries were many, there was really only one river: that we are rational beings and will find human fulfillment through the intellect. Like all rivers, a thoughtful look shows many bends, channels, and undercurrents that give it different appearances even as it flows in a singular direction. We can see John Locke arguing that the mind is a clean slate on which experience is written, and John Hume's skepticism, which countered Locke by demanding concrete evidence for any assertion. And of course, Newton's rejection of metaphysics and supernaturalism. We owe these great intellectual liberators much, and yet I have come to see their almost absolute embrace of the intellect as a paradigm shift in need of tempering. I have thought a lot about empiricism that has guided so much of Enlightenment thought. There is the empiricism inherent in the scientific method, proof arising through evidence. There is a strain of empiricism that discounts anything not directly experienced. And yet, what seems to me our most important tool of language, metaphor, would suggest that we have an inherent need to experience many things indirectly. We describe sleeping as a falling, awakening as a rising, neither of which seems altogether scientific. The building we are in today stands in contradistinction to a lowly stable. Both are metaphors. And of course, my wife's cooking is divine. Metaphor is the concretizing of an abstract idea with an image. It allows us to take something that is difficult to describe or understand and apply it to that which we can see, feel, touch, and perceive. It is a bridge that can span a category of the unknowable on the one bank to the solid ground and grass on the other. My butterflies are a metaphor and should be sufficient to allow me a calmness of faith. Yet often, the path to spirituality has me caught in cross currents of metaphor and empiricism, faith and demand for concrete evidence, frozen in the middle of the bridge. It sometimes plagues me that the empirical me cannot feel more deeply what the poet Dylan Thomas called the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. As a product of the Enlightenment, I believe that the force Thomas describes is nothing more than biological certainty, tracked with a microscope, cell by dividing cell in the reproductive system of butterflies. Yet the force that Thomas wrote about seems so much more compelling than that. It shimmers in the gravel by a river, deepening from pale yellow at the edges to deep, astonishing gold. It dances across the bridge. Many contemporary philosophers, such as Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett, who have some purchase in academic circles, believe there is nothing more than the brain. Dennett wrote in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, "I think that there are no forces on this planet more dangerous to us all than the fanaticisms of fundamentalism. Of all the species, Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, as well as countless similar infections, is there a conflict between science and religion here?" Says Dennis, there most certainly is. While Dennett was writing principally about fanaticism, his rejection of religion as fundamental to a balanced life is not uncommon. It may be seen in the decline of religious affiliation across the country, especially among younger people. For many, religion is seen as patriarchal, authoritarian, and worst of all, hypocritical. That Pope Francis would publicly shame a cardinal who believed he really was a prince is applauded only because it is stunningly unprecedented. I believe that the corruption found in religious institutions has come to stigmatize religion itself. It is the structures of organized religion that oppress, not the essence, which is the joy of questioning. Many scholars, such as Dennett, would disagree with me. They believe that we are simply the result of trillions of neurons connected by synapses that, weak beings as we are, bother us with the wholly irrelevant question of why. Their equation is simple. Until it can be proven, it is of no use. Like these philosophers, I simply cannot bring myself to believe in a deistic God that is remote or a supernatural God keeping score. How could such a God of mine leave the Phillies in such disrepair? Nevertheless, while I may agree with the why of life is an uncomfortable question, given that it has no definitive answer, I cannot dismiss it, not because I'm afraid of divine retribution or am in need of a comfort that counters the dread of the unknown, but because life is too short and too wondrous to be reduced to brain cells and chemicals. I can accept with certainty that the brain is a complex organ that developed over eons. I accept the science that tells me what it is composed of, how it works. Still, while neuroscience may have the last word on the science of the brain, I believe to deny a bridge from it to the mind To deny a connection between our biological selves and our spiritual selves is where the danger is. Not in Dennis's argument that religion inevitably infects intellect. To look at the mating dance of butterflies and see only a biological phenomenon is to flip a switch that leaves half of our human experience cold and dark. Metaphor is not the knife and fork we use to eat. They are simple tools that have names. But I must say that the design of flatware raises questions beyond its utility. Metaphor is how we explain the pleasure we derive from eating. Spend a few minutes with my good friend Sam Gugino. He'll be happy to illustrate my point. Metaphor is not a rose, which we know is of a specific biological family, and that its properties, at least originally, evolved in ways that afforded it some advantage in the struggle for survival. I don't know if the poet Robert Browning thought of it that way, but I know he wrote that his love is like a red, red rose. When I come to church, I never know what I will feel, but I know that I'll experience something by the end of service. Sometimes what I feel has no connection to the sacred. I get lost looking around. Fragments of a busy week float in and out. And then all of a sudden, announcements are being read. But as we pass the peace, or I wave at someone a few rows back, I know that I've been someplace special. As with catching fish, experiencing the sacred may be the goal of coming to church, but it is not the objective. Still, I like to catch fish. And there are times, great many times, when I do feel a connection to the sacred. It may be in the beauty of the stained glass, the way the ringing of the prayer bowl gathers us in, a marvelous musical selection such as we heard this morning, a hymn, or something in the sermon that connects me to the force in Dylan Thomas's poem. So there is a phenomenon that is abiding, that I feel rather than experience empirically as the reason I come here. I am always conscious of the deep connection I have with all of you, with all those who came before us, and with those who will come after us, and for whom we have a deep responsibility to preserve this sacred space. I am moved at our signing ceremonies when the book is opened and by virtue of metaphor transcends paper and binding and becomes Edward W. Clarke, who signed first on November 26, 1865, and Crystal W. Penn, who signed January 19, 2014. And I know that everyone through all those years is one, and I am part of that singularity. At that moment, I have affirmed that Hitchens and Dennett are wrong. I know the brain is different from the mind. I know that the brain calculates while the mind searches, and metaphor is the bridge. I know that science and religion are connected so that we may fully explore the wonders of life. I've experienced three times in my life an epiphany of butterflies. What I saw was the result of an evolutionary process. What I have come to know is that the experience was profound, ineffable, and necessary to my spiritual development. The experience and the memory of it moves me closer to understand the places where the sacred may be found, as does being here when together we celebrate the spirit of life. Amen. Thank you.